Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for grabbing part two of our conversation with journalist Pepe Escobar. In part one, we talked about the new tensions in the Middle East, and we also talked about his remarkable interviews with former Brazilian President Lula da Silva and his successor, Dilma Rousseff. Today, this portion of our conversation covers the latest events in Hong Kong. Susie and the Banshees get us into the podcast today, and Pepe Escobar lived in Hong Kong on and off for many years. He has a real affinity for the city and a deep knowledge of its politics. And here he shares his knowledge about the protests that have roiled Hong Kong all summer long and the role that the U.S. may be playing. Also, the role of the oligarchs, the old money people who control Hong Kong. It's a fascinating look at a complex situation. This podcast made possible by listeners like you with your subscriptions. People like Elizabeth Vasquez, Brian Massey, Stuart Russell, and Suzanne Bowen. I'd like you to join them and kick in $5 or $10 a month. Just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You'll hit the sign up page, and from there, I think you can figure it out. Finally, Pepe, I'd like to talk to you about Hong Kong, where you lived for many years, and I read your dispatch at Asia Times about your recent visit there. Tell me what you see going on, and respond to the claims from some journalists in America that the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, is investing heavily in the protests in Hong Kong. Is that visible? Is that apparent in any way? Or do you view this as purely organic?
No. It's a mix of both. The protests against the local government, they absolutely proceed because the local government in Hong Kong, which is basically picked by 1,200 unelected people, and obviously the approval from Beijing is absolutely essential. It's basically a government of oligarchs, to the benefit of oligarchs. And Beijing had an understanding with these oligarchs. Okay, you take care of Hong Kong for us. Okay, don't screw up. The problem is they did screw up. And Carrie Lam, now the current CEO, She could not manage a high school. Can you imagine a society as complex as Hong Kong? She fucked up big time. So everything that people complain about the government being completely divorced from the needs of the population is true. Life in Hong Kong has nothing to do with this glitzy myth of being Manhattan in Asia. No, for most people, it's very, very hardcore. The median salary, for instance, the average salary for, let's say, a couple in Hong Kong is $2,200 a month. Just to give an idea, if you want to rent a one-bedroom apartment, 50 square meter in a decent neighborhood, it will be at least $3,000 a month, if not $4,000 a month. So it's the craziest real estate market on the planet. Nobody can buy anything. Nobody can rent anything unless your company rents for you. For the young generation, they have to live with their parents because they cannot afford to live by themselves. Everything is controlled by basically a cartel of six large groups that control 90% of the economy. There is this myth as well in the West that is the freest society, the freest market in the world is Hong Kong. It's not. It's bullshit. This is what the Heritage Foundation is trying to sell to Americans, which is absolute bullshit. This is a society controlled by a cartel of six oligopolies. That's how the economy in Hong Kong works. Years ago at Asia Times with a Hong Kong colleague of mine, we spent 1 month doing a dossier detailing everything that an average Hong Konger does that involves one of all of these six members of the cartel in his daily life. You know, the supermarket that he goes to, the newspaper he buys, the car dealer that he goes to, you name it. Everything is controlled by the cartel. So the real estate speculation. Most of them are involved in real estate speculation. So obviously, you see a vicious cycle where if you finish a very good university, for instance, like Hong Kong University, it's an excellent university, City University of Hong Kong, same thing. Forget about getting a job. Forget about getting a place to live. You're gonna have the Hong Kong equivalent of a Mac job. You don't want to work in China because there is a superiority complex of a sort of, as the French would say, un fan gâté, a complex that we are better than the mainland Chinese, which are a bunch of locusts, mm-hmm. according to the local terminology in Cantonese. Mm-hmm. There is the conflict between the province and the seat of power, the Cantonese-speaking province and the Mandarin-speaking center of power, which is historical in China. If you don't understand this, you don't understand the internal dynamics of Hong Kong as well. And the fact that the people who are who have property and savings in Hong Kong, the majority of the people, are escapees of 1949 in China. They escaped Mao, the revolution, the People's Republic of China, and they developed an total aversion to all things mainland Chinese. This is the bulk of the people who are behind the protests. And there's another smaller bulk, let's put it this way, the people who came after 49, but they don't have anything. They don't have property. They don't have savings. They are in a very precarious situation. And their sons and daughters, the same thing. They don't go to very good schools. Their prospects for the future are lousy. So they are also blaming the local government for all this and also blaming China by proxy. So it's very complicated. And apart from all these, you have the people who actually lived in Hong Kong before the Opium Wars in the 1840s. Let's say these are between 25% to 30% of the local population. These people, because they don't have any problems with China, they actually have no grudge against China, and they do not support the protests. They think that, they are, because they are relatively established, and they don't have a memory of being persecuted by the communists, let's put it this way. They are okay with everything, even if they complain about, of course, the high cost of living in Hong Kong. So it's a very fragmented, divided society, of course. And the fact that with all these decades of British imperial dominance, in their subconscious, they see themselves as more Westerners than Chinese, which is completely crazy, but that's what it is. You know, they have more affinity with London or to eating roast beef with Yorkshire pudding than actually behaving like your average Cantonese from southern China. Mm-hmm. They speak English fluently. They have property. Some of them have property abroad. Their second home is usually Canada, not the U.S., usually Canada. And if they can afford it, in the U.K., somewhere in the U.K. So you know, it's a sort of Stockholm syndrome element in all this, which is very, very interesting. And everything that comes from China, by definition, is pernicious. It's communist and does not respect Hong Kong freedoms. Obviously, they haven't read the one country, two systems basic law very well, because all these liberties are in the basic law. They are being respected. The problem is the local government does not apply it very well, because in terms of land redistribution, for instance, in terms of trying to reframe real estate speculation, they don't do anything. It's what the oligarchs tell them to do. So now the Chinese, what did they do? Something fantastic. They sent a task force from Beijing to Shenzhen, you know, ultra high level functionaries. They based themselves across the border. They were doing back and forth Shenzhen and Hong Kong. They studied what happened this past 2 or 3 months. Obviously, Chinese style, they had their super report at the end. The report landed at the desk of the Politburo. So now they come up, okay, now we're going to reorient the whole thing. So now, from now on, the way they're going to deal with Hong Kong is no more privileges. In a very Chinese way, they are saying that now they are going to plow the field. That is, they're going to get rid of the fifth columnists who are especially in the local government. Example, teachers in high schools that were brainwashing their students to go out in the street to protest against the government and China. So the Chinese are going after these people as well. And they are telling the tycoons, that's it. The party is over. This thing that you control the whole real estate market in Hong Kong and you decide the prices and it's over. It has to start from scratch. So when the dragon starts moving, it's very, very slow. But when they move, watch out, because, you know, things start to really be shaken. And this is what's going to happen from now on, the way I see it. They have a sort of deadline, which is October 1st. They want to get rid of these protests within the next 2 weeks maximum, because October 1st is the anniversary of the foundation of the People's Republic of China. So they want to start from scratch from 2 weeks from now. If there are still a black bloc protests in Hong Kong, for instance, the order is to go there and smash these people for good. The local police, not Chinese police. And they did not fall into the trap of sending tanks to the streets of Hong Kong and doing a sort of Tiananmen 2.0, which is exactly what many people in the West were dying for them to do, so they could have an extra motive to demonize China. No, the Chinese are too smart to fall for this trap, you know. So things are going to change. They already have a roadmap for change. And obviously they want to get rid of this these fifth columnists, rejig the government, and try to find a new way to integrate Hong Kong to southern China, which is part of what they call the Greater Bay Area Project, which is the integration of southern China into a huge node, like the big node around Beijing, the second big node around Shanghai, and the third big node around Guangzhou, Shenzhen, Hong Kong, Macau, and Zhuhai. Mm-hmm. Then you have that fantastic bridge from Hong Kong, Macau, Zhuhai. You have the high-speed rail. Now you take high-speed rail in Hong Kong, you clear customs in Hong Kong, and half an hour later, you are in Shenzhen, you are in mainland territory. So this is integration. And the Hong Kongers complain about this. Can you believe this? This bridge is worth nothing. Who wants to get a bridge to go to Macau? We don't need that shit. High-speed rail to Shenzhen. We don't want to go to Shenzhen. We're going to go to London. it's completely stupid. You know, they think that they are in an island. They are overprivileged people living in an island, and they are not part of China. Forget it. This is a special administrative region, SAR. You are part of China. Live with it. But after 150 years of Imperial Britain, mm-hmm. try to explain that to them. When I was there on Saturday, it was fantastic. I saw two mini protests. One of them was in front of the UK consulate. Everybody with UK flags, some of them with Hong Kong colonial flags. And I was asked, okay, what do you want? I said, we want a proper British passport. I said, so you don't give a fuck about Hong Kong. You want to leave? I said, yes, because we have a British national overseas passport, and it's worth nothing. We want a proper passport, so if China comes here, we can have a place to go. Ridiculous. And the other mini protest was there were a lot of people with American flags, French, Ukrainian, Hong Kong colonial. The same thing. I say, people from Europe, they should help us because these Chinese are going to come here and do another Tiananmen, etc. So, pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. And then when you have a more decent conversation, for instance, Hong Kong University. And then it was great because they said, look, we want more wealth redistribution. We want a proper policy to have more public housing for people in need. That's this is at least, it's a sound conversation with involving sound policies. And these people don't want to abandon Hong Kong. They are proud to be Hong Kongers, but they want a Hong Kong that works for most people and not only for the 1%, But it's fascinating, Peter, because there are so many levels. And it's the highest urban density on the planet. So you have 7 million plus people in a very small area. And you have from extra zillionaires to people living in cage homes, almost side by side. So in terms of an anthropological, sociological experiment, it's unique in the world. And it was bound to implode and explode. In fact, it took too long. The handover was 22 years ago. Remember. I was there. I covered the handover the whole month before the handover. I was there. I remember that people were absolutely terrified. They thought that at midnight, the day of the handover, the tanks would start rolling in Central.
Right.
completely out of proportion paranoia, in fact. And when they saw that everything would be normal, people started to, the first few years, the city started to become a little more cantonized. Expats started to leave. After 15, 18 years, it was it looked like a big Chinese city where most people speak Cantonese, but it was not as international as before. And nowadays it's more or less the same thing. Nowadays it's not the English colony that it was 22 years ago. It's a less internationalized city for the average Hong Konger. And at the same time, you have these trappings for the 1 to 5%, where you have the best of the best that the world has to offer. But it's for a very small minority. The average Hong Konger simply cannot afford going to these restaurants or to shopping these malls, And they feel it. They know it. And they don't like it.
Well, last time I was there, I popped into the Mandarin Hotel, and it was $50 for a cocktail. And I
say exactly.
I went down the street to McDonald's and had a soda.
How can you do that when you make $2,500 and your rent is probably $2,000?
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that the Chinese sometimes they're very slow to learn. But it's the Deng Xiaoping system, crossing the river while feeling the stones. In this case of Hong Kong, they try to cross the river, they felt the stones, and now they have a roadmap and they're going to deal with Hong Kong in a much, I would say, not harsher, but more decisive way than before. Because now they want to show them, look, that's it. There's no turning back. You're part of the mainland. And you have only a few years to integrate yourselves to this node in southern China, where you're going to profit from it. If you don't want to do it, it's very simple. We'll leave you to your own devices. We'll forget about you, and you're going to become a Disneyland or a sinking Venice without the beautiful Palazzi. You know, that's what's going to happen.
Well, Pepe, I always learn a lot talking with you. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll certainly be watching all of these situations, Iran, Hong Kong, and, of course, Brazil, over the coming months. Pepe, many, many thanks, and you stay well.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to part two of our conversation with Pepe Escobar. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.